Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Legalizing drugs. Is it actually scary, or do we just need a better conversation? This is what we're going to talk about. This is Stop and Search on Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Leak UK. And here we go. Behind your barricade. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricade. Where to bow the southern stream. Thanks for joining us again, guys. So this one, what are we going to talk about? Well, Mr. Steve Rolls, a good friend of mine, and senior policy analyst at Transform Drug Policy Foundation. He wrote a book, and it's a fantastic book. It's honestly probably the most notes I've ever made whilst reading the book, and it's a perfect explainer on what legalizing drugs actually means. And it's called Legalizing Drugs, The Key to Ending the War. So please do look it up. Please do buy it and lend it. Lend it to someone. Let them understand this debate. So joining us on this panel, we've got Steve Rolls. We got Ollie Pollard from a documentary series called The Highs and Lows of the Weed Business. And if you're a regular to Stop and Search, you would have heard Ollie because he joined us a few months back. And you can find his documentaries on 4 On Demand. And if you're listening to this on a cast, then the link will be scrolling as we speak. And also join us is Dr. Judith Yates, who again is just such a magnificent voice. She's a former GP, lives in Birmingham. She's now a member of the IDHDP, which is the International Doctors for a Healthier Drug Policy. Which, how can you argue with that? It just makes complete sense, doesn't it? So let's get on with this. Let's listen to what we've got to say about legalising drugs. Is it the key to ending the war? I think we can introduce our panel. So, from the end, we have Ollie. Ollie, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name's Ollie. And I'm a freelance producer and director, and I think I'm here because I made a series, short form series last year, called The Highs and Lows of the Weed Business, which was about specifically Denver and Colorado and what's going on there. And so we went during 420, and there's six little films that cover different aspects of the industry there.
And Steve Rolls, I think you need no introduction, but do it anyway.
I'm Steve Rolls. I'm a senior policy analyst for Transform Drug Policy Foundation, which is a sort of advocacy and policy analysis think tank based in the UK, but working internationally, focused on drug policy and law reform, with a particular focus on legalising drugs. And regulating drugs once they are legalised. And I'm also author of the smash hit new book, Legalising Drugs, The Key to Ending the War.
Which is going to star Johnny Depp. And we have Judith Yates. Can you introduce yourself, Judith?
I'm a GP from Birmingham, and I've worked with people who use drugs and alcohol as well as being their GP for 35 years. I'm now more or less retired from being a GP, but I'm looking around and thinking things aren't right in the drug policy world at all.
And I think a round of applause at that stage to our panel. See, I like doing it that way because it's a little bit infinite monkey cage. I think if we can sort of just ride on the back of what they do, I think we can't go wrong with the podcast world. But I think we need to start with Steve. Why did you write the book? is if I need to ask?
Well, I mean, I've been working for Transform, doing policy work and advocacy for nearly 20 years. And actually, I've written a lot of stuff, and the Transform team has produced a lot of stuff, including a series of books on how to legalise and regulate drugs. So the work we do, some of it is critiquing the problems of the war on drugs. Some of it is kind of trying to sort of flesh out a vision of what a post-prohibition world looks like. And some of it is sort of a guide to how to get from one to the other, kind of about how to advocate for changes in policy, how to advocate for better drug policy, and how to advocate specifically for legalization and regulation. But what this book aims to do is really to distill a lot of the other books and reports and briefings and analysis that we've done in the past into one kind of neat sort of digestible package. And it's been written, a lot of the stuff that I've certainly done in the past is almost sort of aggressively dull policy stuff, which is only interesting if you're like a serious sort of, you know, drug policy nerd, or you know, a technocrat bureaucrat, you know, sort of like, what should the font size be on the health warnings on your you know, cannabis labeling, that level of detail that I don't think you know, you people are necessarily going to be that interested in, unless some of you are very dull. but what we wanted to do with this book was to distill some of that analysis and thinking and wisdom that we've accrued over the last 20 years or so, and put it into one sort of neat package where we kind of tell the story in a bit more of a kind of narrative way. So it starts off with a kind of history of the war on drugs, and how it's had its roots in sort of racism in the US and exploitation of the drugs issue by various political and financial forces, and how any kind of sense of public health as the driving force of it got lost many, many generations ago. And then it highlights really what all the harms are. So all the problems that you're all, I would guess, most of the, by the fact you're here, you'll all mostly be familiar with the fact that the war on drugs has been somewhat counterproductive. Whether it's, you know, increasing health harms, whether it's fueling crime, whether it's undermining security and development in places like Colombia and Central America and Central Asia and Afghanistan, whether it's wasting scarce police resources, all of these harms are, I think, have been very well chronicled. But I sort of summarise them in there. But then it goes on to what I think we're supposed to be talking about tonight, which is, what does if we all agree that war on drugs doesn't work, well, what is the alternative? And even if we say, yes, okay, we all think that we need to sort of end prohibition, then really the debate moves on to where I think where it should be, which is, well, what does that world look like? You know, what would the legal regulatory framework be for different types of drugs? Because it wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't regulate cannabis in the same way that you would regulate MDMA or cocaine or heroin or methamphetamine or LSD. They all need some very careful thought about different elements of the market and how you'd regulate them to deal with the different risks and social harms and social benefits potentially associated with their use. So Just basically breaking that down, I think, and spelling it out for people starts to get people thinking in the right place. Rather than should we or shouldn't we legalise and regulate, it's actually, once we've legalised, how do we regulate to deliver the kind of outcomes, the kind of policy outcomes that we all want to see? And we all want to see the same things. We all want to see improved public health, reduced crime, human rights being defended, security and development not being undermined, protection of children and young people. And I've got two children here. we all care about those things for obvious reasons. The current policy is clearly not delivering it. The question is, what kind of regulation is going to deliver those shared goals? And interestingly, those shared goals are shared between everybody, whether they're even prohibitionists and drug warriors. Actually, no one wants more crime or you know, ill health or children to be put in jeopardy or, you know, human rights to be undermined. Everyone wants that. The question is, how do we deliver it? And once we agree that the war on drugs isn't the way, the question is, how do we do it? What's the best regulation model? So the book doesn't go into enormous detail on that, but it at least outlines the structure of, you know, the products themselves, the vendors? How do you license and regulate the vendors? How do you license and regulate the outlets? Who has access to that market? How do you do age controls? All these sorts of questions are in many ways obvious and familiar in terms of legal products that we're all used to. And I've got a sticky bun here. Very bad for you. I've got a beer here, also very bad for you. But they are regulated, the beer more than the sticky bun, as appropriate to their relative risk. And it's the same. We need to do the same thing with drugs. So cannabis would probably be regulated more like alcohol and tobacco, or like the coffee shops in the Netherlands. Things like MDMA, sort of party drugs and stimulants that people use in the nighttime economy, would probably be available under some sort of licensed retail, perhaps from pharmacies, a kind of pharmacy model with a trained and licensed gatekeeper to accessing the market. And then more dangerous drugs, you know, injectable drugs and some of the more dangerous stimulants might only be available through a kind of medical model like we have with methadone and prescribed heroin, which already happens in this UK. So heroin is actually already legally supplied to dependent drug users in the UK. So the idea of, oh, let's legalise heroin, well, you don't need to. It's already legal for that. So, and a lot of the things that are proposed in here and that have been proposed by Transform and our work historically are based on existing models. So prescription models of heroin, that's what we advocate. We just think it should be more available. Legal cannabis, obviously lots of places all around the world are already doing that, in California and in Uruguay and Canada. And in the Netherlands and all over the place, in Jamaica. So we're already getting a lot of experience and evidence about how to do that properly or how to do it not so well. And there are mistakes being made and, you know, policy has to evolve based on evidence. In a way, the place we've got least evidence, I think, is probably the stimulants in the middle. There aren't really very many good examples of legally regulated stimulants. So that would be a more experimental model. But one of the other things that we say is that we need to move forward cautiously in small increments, in a phased manner, and see what works. And if it's not working, be willing to take a step back, but also to be flexible and but bold as we move forward, but always based on evidence of what delivers those shared common goals. So the last bit of the book is then looking at some of these examples. So I look at Colorado, we look at Uruguay, it's only me wrote it, Switzerland and heroin prescribing. I say it, but it is we actually, because there were loads and loads of people, my friends and colleagues from Transform and beyond, some of whom are here, have helped and fed into it and provided feedback and evidence and suggestions and guidance on the contents of the book. So it's actually a collective effort. And then the final chapter is looking at a bit more of the political analysis. How do we make the case? So it's more of a kind of almost like an advocacy guide, how to talk about it, how to use human narratives to engage the public with difficult policy issues, how to use evidence, but not to rely too much on evidence, because if people have got a sort of emotional commitment to a particular policy position, evidence doesn't really help change. You have to engage them where they are, look at what values do they care about, what's really going to reach them at an emotional level. And you have to paint a picture and provide a vision of the future and of a world where drugs are legally regulated and available that they will buy into and be willing to get behind, because policy is only really going to change when the public make it worth politicians' while. Unfortunately, there are a few politicians who are going to show leadership on this, a very few, people like Mujica in Uruguay. But for the most part, politicians are power hungry and cynical, and they will only change when the political, you know, cost-benefit analysis is in their favour. And that basically means public opinion coming round. That's what's happened in America. That's what's happened in Canada with cannabis. And I think probably in the UK and the rest of the world, you have to win over the public first and find champions in the political domain who will then pick up the baton and take it forward. But yeah, that's what the book's about. I hope it's a reasonably approachable, readable version of that story, but you'll be the judge of that.
I think that deserves a round of applause on that alone. I think one of the things that struck me, Judith, when I was reading it, because I know you've read it as well, is that it's very much a book that you can lend. It's not just the one that you read yourself. You make sure that you've got to digest this and give it to someone else that can convince them of reform. And I know from a position of a doctor, it's quite an issue that you're obviously really, really passionate about. Would you say as well that what Steve said, that the delivery of information is just as important as the information itself?
Yeah, it's clearly a coffee table book to leave in there. Yeah, drug policy based on evidence. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I'm one of 1,428, I just looked it up at the moment, doctors, medical doctors from more than 100 countries around the world asking for, we're part of something called International Doctors for Healthier Drug Policies. And we're looking at the unintended consequences of the so-called war on drugs on our patients. And my, I suppose my standpoint, starting point as a doctor was the harm that was being done to my individual patients, and then looking around the world at the harm that's being done to all around the world. And when I retired from being a GP and became a bit more involved in this and looking at these policies, I started going to the United Nations, which anybody can find a way to do if you're interested. And I went to Vienna and listened to these governmental people talking about policies which had absolutely no basis in evidence and absolutely no basis in helping my patients to a better and healthier life, and quite the opposite. And one of the things which shocked me, which is definitely mentioned in Steve's book, but I wasn't aware of. I was a GP in Birmingham, in England, in the UK. I'd got access to all the medicines I needed. I could prescribe methadone for people who needed it, or morphine for terminal care for people who needed it. And until I went to Vienna, and the people at the United Nations explained it to me, I didn't know that one of the unintended consequences is that over 90% of the world's painkillers, morphine-based painkillers, are used by 17% of the population, which is Europe, America, and Australia. I wasn't aware of that. And the UN themselves say that this is wrong, this is not intended. Over 5 billion, apparently we have 7 billion people in the world, I had to look that up. 5.5 billion people have little or no access to opiate painkillers for terminal care. I didn't know that until 4 years ago. But since I realised that, I'm shocked. And the reason is not because it's against the UN conventions. The reason is because the policy has been rolled out in such a cack-handed way, if you like, looking only at criminalising people who use drugs and not concentrating on what was written down in the original conventions, which is getting proper access to medicines for those who need them. And we all have human right to access to medicines. And there are people from the hospice movement going around the world now trying to put this right. But the reason this had happened, it had to be explained to me, because I said, is that right? That can't be right. The reason it's happened is because the regulations have been so strict, have been so difficult, that lower income countries haven't been able to afford to put into place all the border controls and all the legal things and train the doctors and the nurses how to tick these boxes, which in the UK we have the privilege to be able to do. So the sooner we can change these laws which underpin this and start to move forward with policies which actually help the human race rather than harming most of the human race, the happier I will be as a doctor.
Such a powerful voice, isn't it? The doctors that are there for a healthier drug policy. It's really difficult to argue with that. At what point was there a light bulb moment for you? Was it within your work, or was it when you stepped outside it?
Well, it was within my work as I went along. I've read with interest Neil Wood's book, which is also very much worth a read, actually. Describing the work of the undercover police who my patients had told me about in some detail over the years. And some of my patients in the inner city Birmingham have got tangled up with the police trying to do what we asked them to do at the time, which is, you know, policing the use of drugs and trying to catch people who are using as well as people who are... And my patients, who are the most vulnerable, the most... unsuccessful of people in Birmingham who are using drugs in the very much in the inner city and on the streets and the street homeless, end up being again unintended victims really of this so-called war on drugs, and they would end up getting arrested in order for the police to be able to ask them where they got their drugs from, in order to be able to look for the big nasty violent people higher up. But in the process, I'd been working with this patient you know, maybe for some years. And I got them into a nice hostel and they were on the housing ladder waiting for their flat. And then they'd disappear off into prison on remand. They might not get a custodial sentence because they're only little tiny people. Who cares what happens to them? But I cared as their GP. I'd known their parents. I knew their cousins. I knew their aunts. And by the time they came out after the court case 3 months later, they'd fallen off the housing ladder. All these little people getting damaged by... for no good reason, for no actual positive reason that I could understand. So that's what made me think things weren't right.
And it is, it's all those little... Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's those little things that add up to the bigger picture. And there's a thing in Steve's book that says that people in Southeast Asia are still getting executed fundamentally for...
Yeah.
A proportional amount of cannabis, which you can now legally buy in Colorado. Mm. So that's how diverse and perverse our drug policies become internationally. And I think Ollie's a good one to speak about what a legal system now looks like, because in the highs and lows of the weed business, which you can find on Channel 4 On Demand, which absolutely go and find it, it's six documentaries?
Yeah. Six, yeah.
The highs and lows of the weed business. It's on Channel 4 Weed. Wheat. Yeah, he also...
It's all about bread. Well. It's just about bread, yeah.
And absolutely gluten-free. And can I just say for the listening audience, Steve Rolls is still eating his sticky bum, which is the first for this podcast. So, Ollie, I mean, how did you get to the point where you was interested in the weed business, both functioning and you really went down and saw every aspect of what was going on from both the what's now happening in legal money moving down all the way down to consumption?
Steve will know more about this, but there are different ways to run, you know, a system of legalization. And my insight is not probably as good as the other panel members or you, Judge. But so my understanding is just mainly of Colorado, I guess, in that US model. And I guess what interested me from like just as a producer and somebody who makes shows and internet stuff is that I found this money thing really fascinating, which is not a model I don't think we have in the UK. We couldn't really have, in that drugs in the US are very different to how they're, you know, policed or what the laws are here, is that federally it's still illegal to buy weed, even though as a state, if you lived in Colorado or Washington State or now California, you could buy weed. Under state law, but under federal law, still illegal. So if you say you went from Colorado to another state that wasn't legal, you would be breaking the law. Even though you legally bought something that's totally legal in another state, it would be transporting kind of illegal goods over the border. And equally, this is why there's so much money in Colorado. 2016, they made $1.3 billion in cannabis sales. Because it's still federally legal, it's a lot of cash because nobody wants to pay with plastic. So in a lot of the dispensaries we went to, there's cash machines. So they'll say, have you got any money? And people from out of state will try and pay on a card, not knowing that really they don't want to do that. So that was the first thing I read, was this article about how it's just a really cash-rich city. And I think that's what got me interested in it, because I just thought that was a kind of fascinating subject. And then after that, that opened me up to all the other stuff. So one of those was the security industry. So there's a really weird dichotomy in Colorado, is that there's security firms now that do just that. They just move weed and cash around the city. So from a dispensary to a bank. And that the company we kind of hung out with for a while, and we went on a ride along, their words, not mine, but a ride along in their armored truck, that was owned and run by an ex-policeman, and pretty much all his staff were either ex-military or ex-police. So it was a really odd, you know, odd situation there, that you had policemen who were arresting a few years ago, literally only a few years ago, the very same people for carrying a bit of weed. And you know, it's a bigger conversation to have about the prison system in America, but you know, there's millions of, almost I would say, of you know, usually African-American men in prison for a tiny bit of weed, which is just, for me, feels wrong. We talked about human rights earlier. That would be one of them. You know, it just seems so odd. But anyway, but that city is changing, and that for me, for an outsider and not a smoker of weed, it wasn't why I went. it wasn't hard to get high. I mean, there's certain rules they have, and just before we started, Steve was saying that he didn't really advocate that model in Colorado, but one of the things they do have is that you can't smoke in public. So you can't smoke, you just can't smoke light up in the street with a joint or whatever. Not that actually a lot of people smoke joints, but you can smoke in your own home. That has problems as well. If you rent, people can get evicted quite easily. So they have weed buses. So when we were there, it was 420, which I'm sure most of you will know about. And so that weekend, there's a load of stuff going on. We went to this little kind of down and out bit of town, and it was just kind of fun, little kind of pop-up festival. And outside, this guy, this real character, had this bus, essentially his RV, classed in America, as only the Americans can, as a home. So as soon as you stepped on the bus and you had a bit of resin or you smoked a joint or you did whatever you wanted to do, you were totally legally smoking. So if you stepped off that bus and the police came past and you were smoking a joint, you'd get arrested. But that's how they got around it. So it wasn't hard to get high if you sat on the bus for half an hour. But no, so my knowledge is just of Colorado, I guess, and it's working. I mean, I came away from it because I came with quite an open mind in that I'm not a smoker. I'm not probably like a lot of you. I didn't know an awful lot. I'm not going to claim I did, and that was part of the reason for doing it. And I came away, I guess, with quite a clear opinion of what I think about drug policy, specifically about weed, I think. And I do think we need to change. And I find it kind of embarrassing that somebody, you know, in this country, if Tim Farron brings up the idea of maybe looking at legalizing weed, he's kind of laughed at a little bit by some political establishments. And I just think it's really childish. I think we need to have an adult, open, honest debate about what the pros and cons are.
And that's where Steve makes the point in the book of, and it's always a theme of this podcast, of this is a social movement. Is it going to come from the top down or is it going to go from the bottom up? And I think the consensus, Johan was here last month, he was very much making the case, wasn't he, Neil, that it is a social-led approach that is going to eventually pop the Westminster bubble. And I think you make that point as well, Steve, is that there has been certain examples and certainly the state-by-state examples in America, especially Colorado, have been socially led and have gone against policymakers' wishes. Do you think that is that got any real benefit or non-benefit within the discussion?
I mean, the way that reform happens does influence the nature of the outcome. So if you look at the US, for example, with the cannabis reforms, they are all ballot initiative-led reforms. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean that the model laws, or in Colorado's case, I think it's Colorado, that they actually was a constitutional reform, wasn't it? They actually redrafted the constitution.
It was an amendment, I think.
Was it? So
exactly the same thing.
But the key thing is that the people designing those policies that were then voted on were essentially activists, often working with the industry. Now, again, not necessarily a bad thing, but it may mean that the type of model that you get will prioritise the interests of activists and industry over, say, the interests of, say, public health or parents and child welfare. Now, I'm not saying that those things were abandoned, and they certainly haven't been, but there is clearly there's an obvious tension when we get to this discussion about regulation. There's an obvious tension between the interests of business and profit-making commercial entities and the interests of public health institutions. In the businesses want to make, they're interested in making money, and that generally involves increasing the amount of stuff they sell, which means more drug consumption, whether it's weed or alcohol or tobacco or some other drugs in the future. Whereas public health people, their interest will be in moderating use or reducing use, particularly harmful use. And there's a tension there. Depending on which of those two groups or where the balance lies in terms of driving the policy forward will tend to dictate the outcome. So if you look at the models in the US, by no means awful, not necessarily how I would do it, but and the outcomes in Colorado, for example, which is the most well-developed one, are actually pretty good. You know, arrests have gone down by about 85%. Brilliant. Youth use doesn't seem to have increased. There hasn't been some kind of spike in drug-related driving incidents. There have been some not brilliant outcomes. There's been more A&E admissions. There's been some other things that haven't been positive, but may actually reflect a greater, in terms of surveys, may actually reflect a greater openness for people to admit. So you're much more likely to go to A&E if your kid eats some hash brownie or something. Now it's legal than beforehand. So it may be that the data's a bit skewed anyway. But the outcomes in Colorado are pretty good. But if you look at what happened in Canada or Uruguay, where it was a legislatively led process, it's much more public health focused. So in Canada and Uruguay, you're going to have non-branded products and you're going to have a total advertising ban. There will be commercial players in the market, but there won't be those kind of familiar commercial at the availability and supply end. You won't have that kind of visible branding promotional dimension of a commercial market. And I think that's because of it's a legislatively-led product process. So one of the things I'd like to see is for it not to be in the US any more ballot initiatives. I want to see the states and ultimately the federal government picking up the baton and coming up with a proper public health-led policy. Because otherwise you do leave it. I mean, and I don't know whether you heard about what happened in Ohio, but Ohio had a ballot initiative to legalize cannabis and it failed. But it was a total disaster. So what happened was 10 people wrote a ballot initiative to legalize cannabis and got it on the vote, managed to get enough sign-ups to get it a vote on it. And it was a constitutional amendment that awarded a monopoly on the sale of cannabis to 10 people. Guess which 10 it was? It was them. And you're just looking at that going, that's completely outrageous. That is not what we signed up for. I haven't campaigned for all these years to let 10 award themselves a monopoly on the market. It was absolutely outrageous. And luckily, I found myself in the rare position of actually wanting a legalization measure to fail, because it was such a bad sort of role model for the rest of the country and the world that you would have this awful setup. Luckily, it failed, actually, they have a reasonable decrim law in Ohio anyway, so it's not a total disaster. And probably a better ballot initiative will now be put forward, in a couple of years, and I've no doubt it will pass. But there are risks there, and we can get it wrong. So regulation can be done badly. I mean, we've seen from the mistakes with alcohol and tobacco in the past just how wrong it can go. Whilst we have an opportunity here, we also have a great responsibility to make sure that this time that we get it right. Because, you know, if we mess it up, there will be costs. You know, if you do legalization regulation badly, there can be costs. We know what those problems are, and we should, as responsible policymakers, be able to sort of see them coming and mitigate against them by doing it sensibly and doing it right. But that tends to mean having the public health people in charge and not the commercial entities. I can hand over to Judith now.
Public health people in charge. Well, yes, but I think it has to come from both ends. One of the things that I've been involved with trying to do is, we in Birmingham, we have a lot of people in street injectors injecting drugs on the street because we give them the syringes and needles. We've been doing that for 20 or 30 years so that people don't get HIV, and that's quite right. But we know that they've got nowhere safe or hygienic to inject, so they have to go around the back of the car park. So they come into the pharmacy every day, get their needles, syringes, bye-bye, off you go, around the back of the car park, under the canal, inject your drugs, and we'll see you tomorrow. Shocking stupid outcome from silly policy because of the health harms that come from injecting drugs where people can't see you and in dark and unhygienic places. So I've been trying to persuade people that it would be very sensible to allow us to have a drug consumption room in Birmingham where people can just come inside, wash their hands, have the drugs and then talk to somebody about what help they might need on the way out if they'd like some help. And if not, they can come back tomorrow and try again. What I'm trying to say, I think, is that the conversation is changing very rapidly. And it is a very strange and exciting time because things are moving, although frustratingly slowly at times. I spoke to Public Health in Birmingham and they asked the Home Office, well, could we do this? And the Home Office said, absolutely no, it is against all these laws, it is against all the... And it's outside of the United Nations conventions and international law. And I've got an email from the Home Office, which was sent to Birmingham to say, tell the 38s that we can't do this. And now, this year and last year, the International Narcotics Control Board and the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime have said in and put in writing that drug consumption rooms, safe places where people can come inside to use their drugs, can be within the United Nations conventions if they're part of a properly balanced drug treatment service. Well, that's what I was saying all along. So here we are 4 years later, and I'm now asking again. And of course, we have, as you probably know, Glasgow and Dublin and Swansea. The Welsh government are helping Swansea to look at this. And it's kind of sensible, pragmatic approach, but the whole criminalisation debate, the whole war on drugs thing has meant that the people who use drugs are treated as if they're worthless and as if they're criminals, and that's why we need to change a whole lot. But sorry, I think I'm saying we need to change it from the bottom up as well as from the top down, because the top down, they do nothing really, they kind of pass it off. So you need both.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, if I can just jump in, unless you've got something. It certainly seems that the UK at the moment, that is very much the pattern. That with the central government, I mean, obviously there's an election coming up. I don't know, actually, I don't know when this is being broadcast. Maybe it's already happened, but the government...
Greens won.
Yay, Greens! The current government, the current Conservative government, and previous coalition and Tory governments have not been showing any great interest in drug law reform discussions. In fact, they've deliberately been trying to shut them down. And so, what you have seen happen is that the reforms and innovations have been happening at a local level. So we are seeing sort of progressive change, but it feels like the government is kind of letting the local authorities and the local police and the local public health groups and local NGOs assume the political risk. So the central government doesn't have to deal with it. So they assume the political risk. They innovate. They get some credit, but eventually, and then eventually it kind of percolates up to central government. And we're seeing that all over the place. So there's been drug testing at festivals, for example. Two police authorities have authorised that. Now that's beginning to go national this year. We've seen two local police authorities have implemented effective drug decriminalisation for possession. I mean, it's obviously, it depends where you live. You know, you might be unlucky and not live in one of those places. And we're seeing, as you mentioned, supervised injection facilities now being proposed in Glasgow. One's opening in Dublin. I know that's not the UK, but it's quite near. And they're being mooted all over the place again, Brighton and Swansea and North Wales and all over the place. And heroin prescribing, again, although that is legal and does happen on a small scale, it's being seriously proposed for a larger scale rollout, but again at a local level. So we are seeing change, bigger changes being driven by local experimentation. And I think the same is true actually with cannabis reform. So we're seeing little countries like Uruguay and Jamaica and a few states in America are driving policy forward rather than the US federal government, and certainly not the UN. But eventually, when enough countries have legalized and regulated cannabis and it's shown to be a good thing, eventually the UN will have to realign its position and start issuing best practice guidance in the same way they do with alcohol and tobacco.
And I think the delivery of information is something that you make a point of in the book, Steve, is it's all well and good having these discussions, but how do we get them across to the layman on the street that just doesn't care? And I think in Colorado is a good example of how the activists there took the reins and put the pressure on the policymakers. I mean, I think you saw that firsthand, didn't you, Ollie?
And to Steve's point, you can kind of, there's going to be faults in every way they do it, but kind of to Steve's point, it did take people at a local level to make change. And that's bad, because you think that, as you say, federal governments can just wait, see if it works, see if it doesn't work, tell everybody it didn't work, what if it didn't work, and celebrate if it did, because they're making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax. And there's a positiveness to that as well. In Colorado, I think $40 million last year went to schools, just the building schools. That's earmarked, that doesn't go anywhere else, a certain amount has to go. And that's a really positive thing. We could do with that. I mean, let's be honest. We could do with that. Kind of picking up something Steve was saying before. I think from my experience, and maybe it's slightly anecdotal, but the people that want it, obviously the people that want it to work the most are the people that are involved in that policy. And we met a lot of people from businesses. Fair enough, they are making money, but none of them particularly greedily. And then there were policymakers, people who work on Capitol Hill and such. And they all knew, or they all know, the kind of tightrope they're walking on, that any of this stuff could get kind of either voted out if something really awful happened, which is unlikely, probably with weed, but... Or if a government changes, and a lot of people in America will be slightly fearing Trump, I should imagine, because he isn't quite as forward-thinking as others. So it might be that he just decides that, you know, I don't like it, and will make states somehow, change. I don't think he could, because he likes money too much, so I think that would be a bit of a struggle. But no, I think the people that don't want it to fail are the people working in it. And I think there's a slight misconception, you know, that there is a lot of people making a lot of money. Fair enough, that's the way of the world. That will happen. There'll be people making money, you know, if it was just for medical use, there'll be some pharmaceutical. But that was one of the points I got from everybody from across the board that we spoke to, was that actually the great fear was that there's almost a cottage industry feel about Colorado. And Steve's right, you know, there's packaging and branding, and that feels like you're selling something as kind of a commodity and for profit, which you are. But they're the people that don't want it to get thrown away. So they're actually the proactive ones saying, all right, we do have a problem with driving under the influence. So one of the episodes is about a website called the Pot Guide, which initially started in Colorado, and as more states legalized it, it kind of spread its net, as it were, and covers a lot. So you can find out where to stay that's pot friendly. You can go find out what the best strains might be that you can buy in Denver that month, or whatever it might be. But they're really proactive about this driving thing, just to the health and safety bit of it, is that there is no real test. I mean, there is a test, but it doesn't really work, because how weed affects different people in different ways, there isn't really a measure, as there would be with a breathalyzer. But they're the first people to bring that up, because if they can kind of fight that argument before it comes, or at least be informed in that argument, then they can deal with it rather than it all comes at once and it's like this person, you know, we have X amount of accidents and whatever. So yeah, in that sense, I think that they are the best people. I do agree that health kind of professionals and public health professionals should be involved, but I think not everybody's out to get money out of it as much as they might be making some money out of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. I think there's one of the interesting things I think about Colorado, and I don't know whether you this is something you clocked, is that actually two of the key institutions of capitalism, as it were, are patent law and banking, both of which, given the strange, unique nature of Colorado being legal in the context of federal prohibition, are actually absent. So there's no patenting allowed because that's run at a federal level. And there's no banking because you can't bank cannabis money because it's illegal federally and the banks are federally regulated. So actually, you weirdly, although it is quite a commercial model, you do actually have, there's an absence of some of these two key institutions.
Trappings of capitalism. Yeah. And that's totally right.
In a big metal box under their bed.
Well, you can put it in a safe and you can take it to the bank. I mean, one story we heard was that there's a company in Colorado called Medicine Man who actually are trying to move into that Jamaican market, interestingly enough, when we were there. But he was telling me, Andy Williams, who runs that, was telling me stories that he knew companies would come to tax day and they would drive to the bank themselves with a friend with bags of money, and that's how they pay their taxes. So none of it was done digitally at all. So you could still pay because they still want the money. That's the truth of it. The government still want your taxes, so they're probably not going to kind of pull you up on it in the end. But that's how most people would do it. Yeah. And now lots of those businesses that are security businesses have had to expand and include like bank grade safes in their facilities just to house the money from their clients.
There's always been people making big money, and my patients used to have huge safes in their flat. I used to go and visit people in sort of crack houses with steel doors and large safes in the back, and those people weren't paying taxes. So at least now they're paying taxes.
Well, yeah, that's true. They are, you know, so there are some positives. I do agree it probably needs looking at, but like, I guess my bigger point is that those people involved, a lot of the people I met anyway, were at the forefront of recognizing those problems, recognizing those changes. Until it is federally illegal, there will be this issue in America. So it won't be the greatest model because it's never going to happen until they make it federally illegal throughout.
But, I mean, there are other options. There are other types of market that you can consider, and there are, for example, state monopolies in certain countries for alcohol. Russia used to have an alcohol state monopoly. China has a monopoly on tobacco products. The cannabis regulation model in Uruguay that I actually did a little bit of work on a few years ago, it is almost a state monopoly, but the government doesn't produce, and it's actually quite an interesting one because even though the government doesn't produce the cannabis itself, commercial companies do produce the cannabis. So there are still commercial companies involved in the market and there are still people making money. The government is the sole buyer, and the government dictates what they grow, and the government is then the sole supplier for sales from pharmacies. And there's no market, there's no branding, and no advertising. But this stuff will be available. But there are alternative models, and other people have proposed things like having not-for-profit corporations or social enterprises would be the, or what are they called, for-benefit corporations, where you have a commercial entity, but it's working for the community, providing jobs or providing community sort of funding for projects and so on. So there are other options, and it's interesting how the constraints, legal constraints, can drive innovation. So in Spain, for example, there's, I think, nearly 700 cannabis social clubs. Now, cannabis isn't legal in Spain, but there are about 700 of these cannabis social clubs now where you have people have basically taken advantage of their decrim law, which allows individuals to grow a certain number of plants for their own personal use. And what they've done is they've pooled together and 100 people say pool their allowance of two plants, and they grant that allowance to one person who goes and grows 200 plants and then supplies the Cannabis Social Club on a not-for-profit basis. And now there's hundreds of these clubs all over the country now, sort of operating in a kind of weird legal grey area. And there are problems with it. They're not properly regulated and so on. But the interesting thing is that it's developed a sort of community non-profit ethos for production and supply and use, which is actually, I think, rather sort of quite nice. It kind of seems to work quite well, and there's no incentive to, you know, lure young people into evil weed use, or there's no incentive to increase consumption, and there's a sort of supportive community of people who would keep an eye out for you if your use was maybe becoming problematic, or would able to give you advice on safer use, and so on and so on. But crucially, it's a non-profit model of production supply that actually exists, and so you can go and look at it and see how it works and learn from it. And I don't think other places are going to necessarily copy it, although Uruguay did. Uruguay has built in a cannabis social club facility within its legal regulatory model. But you can learn from the fact that other ways of doing it, as opposed to having weed brands sponsor football teams and so on, there are other things you can do. And people laugh when you say that. Oh, look, if we had legal coke, we'd have like the cocaine premiership football. But actually, we have cider brands sponsoring the UK Olympic team.
That's not necessarily good.
No, that's obviously it's really bad. And it was only up until very recently, we had alcohol sponsoring Formula One. Yeah. Formula One, high-speed driving with crashes by booze brands. It's extraordinary.
That's why we need more strict regulation than that.
Right, so those are the kinds of obvious problems that, as responsible policymakers, as we move forward, we would need to make sure we avoid in the future.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But I think that's an easy one.
Yeah.
That's just an easy one. It's been pretty easy with cigarettes. You know,
it took about 30 years.
Yeah, because people were fighting, and not because it was a hard thing to do. It's easy to take a sticker off a sports car.
I think that
would be my point about you can see edibles is a big conversation, right? And I do get that that's a brand and that's sponsored by every rapper under the sun in the States. Do you know what I mean? So everybody's Lil Wayne's got a gummy bear range and whatever. And that I don't think is great. Do I think it's wrong that they have a name or a brand name? No, but I don't think, they should be sponsoring a team. Just as I don't think football teams in the UK should be sponsored by drinks companies or cigarette companies, and they obviously are by cigarette companies. And so, but I think that's an easy one. That's a really easy one to say. Look, that's just not going to happen from the get-go.
That's the beauty of regulation. You can do that, and you can't do that under current circumstances.
Yes, but the battle is to a large extent in the UK been won with tobacco. So you now have plain packaging, there's no advertising, it's behind a screen, it's in a horrible bile green package with a picture of a cancerous lung on it, but you can still buy as much tobacco as you want and smoke as much as you want, but you can't do it in public buildings anymore. And as a result of that, no one's been criminalised. Anyone can buy as much tobacco as they want, but use has actually gone down by about half through effective regulation and investment in public health education. So you can do it, but it has taken about 20 or 30 years because we were fighting at every stage against a sort of rampaging, rapacious tobacco industry who spent millions and millions on lobbyists. Now, the thing with cannabis is we're starting from a blank slate. We can build the right model from the start, and we don't have to worry about big tobacco or big alcohol or big pharma or any other big organized, what are they call
corporations,
stuff.
I'd agree with that.
Also, the culture of how we get there, the conversation. At the moment, we're quite polarised. Everything involving drug policy is polarisation of these drugs are bad, they're going to kill you, versus what they project our image on this side of regulation and reform. How do we get to that position where we can ameliorate the debate and then we can realise that we're all on the same page? We all want, you know, you've got your children, as you said, Steve, you want to protect them. How do we get to that point where we have that communication?
I absolutely right. We have to work at how to get from where we are today to where I would like to be, which is Steve Rolls' picture of a properly regulated system where we know the strength and we know the ingredients and it's all labelled properly and we know exactly what people are taking, and anybody who gets into difficulties can come and see me as a doctor and I can help. Same as we do with alcohol and same as we do with cigarettes, only better, doing it better. I completely agree. But the first harm that I were moving in that direction, that I would love the UK, which almost could happen overnight, as Portugal did, you know, whenever it was, 15, 16, however many years ago, it keeps counting, doesn't it, to decriminalise all drug use. Yeah, personal use. And that to my mind, some drugs, and tobacco and alcohol are worse than cannabis, obviously, but some drugs do some harm, certainly to some people. But criminalising my patients never made them, or only ever added harm to whatever that harm was already happening to them, and just added a layer of harm which they could never recover from because they got a criminal record forever then. And I would love to see us overnight decide to decriminalise in the Portuguese model, and then follow on gradually, you know, with the cannabis first perhaps, and then move gradually towards the other drugs as we work out how to do it and do it safely and people stop being so frightened, because it isn't frightening. Actually, what we've got now is frightening and is dangerous, and what we would be moving towards would be much safer.
I mean, I couldn't agree more, and I it does feel to me that even in the UK, the idea of decriminalising personal possession and use is within reach, even with our successive awful governments, and particularly awful Home Secretaries. Because, you know, in the UK, as I mentioned earlier, we already do have two police authorities have effectively decriminalised drugs within their police authority areas. And I think what we'll see in the next couple of years is that spreading. And you know, next year there'll be four, and next year there'll be 10, and then there'll be 50. And then it starts to become, once the evidence starts to accumulate, it starts to be acknowledged as best practice. And it becomes irresistible for the government to move on it. And it's also worth remembering something like decriminalisation. This is now advocated clearly and openly by the World Health Organization, which is a big, lumbering, conservative, bureaucratic UN entity, is advocating openly for decriminalisation, along with the UN Office on the High Commissioner of Human Rights, along with the UN Development Programme, along with UNAIDS, along with the British Medical Journal and the Lancet and the Royal Society for Public Health and the American Federation of Public Health Officials. And, you know, numerous high, you know, or this isn't just, you know, us sitting up here going, yeah, it's a brilliant idea. This is these big authoritative voices saying that this is an essential prerequisite for an effective public health response to drugs in society. And so, you know, now it's more a case of the government's not arguing with us here. The government's arguing with the World Health Organization and, in fact, the entire UN architecture now. And it starts to become irresistible. So I think that legalization is a much bigger challenge, certainly in the UK, certainly beyond cannabis. But decriminalization, it feels within reach, and to a small extent, it's already beginning to happen. And the MPS Act, the Legal Highs Bill that was passed last year that bans everything that even might get you high. Interestingly, the drugs that are covered by it, they're not criminalised for possession. So, interestingly,
I think they are now, aren't they?
No. Some of the synthetic cannabinoids have been moved into the Misuse of Drugs Act. Sorry, yeah. This is the kind of boring stuff I was talking about.
Techie stuff.
But the government acknowledged that possession of they didn't want to criminalise possession when they prohibited those drugs, because they said, well, that would harm vulnerable populations and, you know, fuel stigma and marginalisation. And you're going, yes. And what about all those other drugs? Come on, what are you doing? So things are moving, I think.
But I'm interested, Ollie, in the difference between what you saw in America to the culture that we got here. I mean, we're kind of almost geared up to address heroin and heroin-assisted treatment and safe consumption rules. We're almost having that conversation before cannabis, whereas it's the complete opposite in America. Why is that? What do you think that can you put your finger on something that the culture of there compared to here and the,
The culture of cannabis is quite different just generally. Like, and I mean like culture as in art. Do you know what I mean? Comedy, film, you know, it's very different. You know, when I said 420 to people in the UK, they didn't know what I was talking about, most people. But us in America, most people knew what 420 was. It's kind of part of mythical folklore of weed smoking. You know what I mean? Most, if you've been to college, you knew what 420 was. But, so that culture is different, for one. And the other one is the, Steve can probably correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think weed is a class A, substance in America. So, to them, that was like a really big jump. It's classed the same as cocaine and heroin, which obviously in this country, although we haven't got to the adult debate of legalization of it, we know it's kind of further down the list of, you know, drugs. And in many ways, it can help people coming out the back of heroin addiction or anything else. You know, it can be
people
quite...
People still go to prison for it.
People still don't go to prison, although I'd argue that the police have a fairly kind of lax attitude even before it was, you know, the
certain Steve's
laws.
Book says there's 11,000 people in prison now.
In the UK?
In the UK for...
Not for cannabis. Not for cannabis possession, but...
For growing I'd some cannabis? Something to do with cannabis?
I think it's more 11,000 people for drug offences generally.
Okay,
but there's still about 27,000 people get a criminal record for possession.
For possession,
so
with,
it's
yeah.
So it's not... I mean, it's going down, but it's not nothing. Mm. 27,000 still... That's still 20,000 too many.
It's a lot of people.
There is a lot of people. I think it's odd. America's an odd place, but I think... And I say that because... Half the states in America are now legal in some way, whether that's medical or recreational, and many states are just medical at the moment. But then they have this massive prison population of young, usually men, with drug convictions. So it's a really weird, you know, it's its own thing. It's probably why Steve's right, he's not the greatest model, but only because I don't think they're system is the best. Not arguing that the UK system is the best either, but you know what I mean? It's quite... odd in that way that you can pass a state law that's still federally illegal. So, but yeah, no, I think the culture of smoking, although there's this horrible stigma, they seem to have grown out of that stigma quicker, maybe. I don't know. I mean, there still is that stigma, don't get me wrong. But yeah, perhaps they've grown out of it a little bit quicker. They're a younger country.
Right. Steve, how much longer have you got before you have to shoot? Because I know you've got your kids here. I'm basically thinking you... want to man your stall over there so that people can go and buy your book.
I'm sticking around.
Cool,
so
there you go.
There doesn't have to be a stampede.
Thank
now.
God for that, right. And let's have a round of applause for these guys. So what did you think? I personally learned a lot from that. That's why I like doing this podcast, because no matter how much I think that I've got this intellectual arrogance on drug policy, I still learn something else, especially when you're faced with people like Steve Rolls and Judith Yates from their respective areas, and Ollie as well, that, you know, embedded within the Colorado culture. You know, you learn so much from these people. So thanks for them for joining us on that panel. It was a hot night, that one. And we all persevered through the sweaty conversation, so to speak. So anyway, on that note, I'm going to do a quick few thank yous again. Thank you to Johnny Borrell for our theme music. Thank you for Nicky Elson, our producer, for doing this. Without him, it'd just be an hour of silence on iTunes. So thanks a lot for that, Nikki. Who else do I need to thank? Oh, John and Jake. I've not thanked them yet. Thank you so much for what you do on the Distraction Pieces Network. If you follow the Distraction Pieces Network social media on Facebook, on Twitter, that's them. And they do so much for us in helping us promote this and getting the word out there. So thanks a lot, John and Jake. There's always people I forget, but... don't forget to follow us on social media at ukleap.org, all that kind of thing. Anyway, you've heard it all before. You don't need me to tell you this. You're probably not even listening by this stage anyway, statistically, you would have logged off. So anyway, on that optimistic note, thanks for joining us again. Make sure you keep logged in on all the stuff that's going on Stop and Search and UK Leap and Transform and IDHDP and all of that. All the links will be on your Cast app. So see you again soon. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.